The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Hypertension is presented by Dr. William Elliott.
Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome to everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and I have to thank the organizers and all my colleagues for arranging this opportunity to spend so long on the airplane so that I could talk about perioperative management of hypertension. I recognize I only have 35 minutes, so let me start with disclosures. Unfortunately, over the years, I've been funded essentially by every pharmaceutical company that makes, markets, and distributes antihypertensive drugs in the United States, but not in the last year. So my sins have been forgiven. This is CME, so we have to have the affidavit of originality. The following material is based exclusively on the spin-off own opinion, knowledge, and expertise. There's no organization, company, or entity that has exercised any control or influence over the content of the presentation, nor has any other person or organization had any part in drafting, scripting, or designing content. The information presented is based on the principles of evidence-based medicine, is intended to avoid promotion of any specific commercial interest, product, or company, so help me God. We do have concerns about off-label use. You may know that there is no drug in this country that has been approved for perioperative hypertension. Therefore, everything I say is off-label. Run for the exits. There's a big disclaimer on here. I'm going to skip that because I only have 35 minutes. I have lots more disclaimers too. Some things I'm not going to talk about. You have to come to the American Heart Association meeting on the 13th of November to hear about the new hypertension guidelines. No further comment. So we'll move on to perioperative management of hypertension and an internist perspective. Where I work, we're not allowed to have lectures any longer, but we are allowed to have sessions where we have each one associated with educational objectives. So here they are. At the end of this, if you're still awake, you should be able to provide a plan and appropriate justification for it. For a 68-year-old man in your practice whose elective surgery was canceled at 6:30 in the morning on a scheduled scheduled procedure because he had a blood pressure in the pre-anesthesia preparation room of 186 over 108. Secondly, you should be able to recommend which antihypertensive medication should be held and which should be taken on the morning of an elective surgical procedure, not including cardiac surgery, by the way. That's a whole different topic that's being handled in the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons Convention just across the way. And lastly, explain why the perioperative management of hypertensive patients is now inexorably linked with concerns about ethics and scientific integrity. There is nothing more important in Washington, D.C. than ethics and scientific integrity. So I have to bring that to your attention. All right. Moving on. So as you may know, if you did surgery as a third year, blood pressure often goes up, especially before surgery. Most of that's due to anxiety and pain, what we call the white coat effect, and medication withdrawal. And it turns out that elevated blood pressure is either the number one or two reason for postponed surgery in three large series, one from England, two from the United States. It turns out if you did anesthesia as a student, or even more recently, you know that intubation and induction of anesthesia often raises blood pressure and heart rate, and that phenomenon, both of those phenomena, are more common in chronically hypertensive people. The bigger concern for anesthesiologists is not so much hypertension, as I'll show you in a moment, they don't really care about that. Hypotension, however, is a very big issue, and that is exacerbated in their work by anesthetic agents, especially IV anesthetics. Reduced sympathetic tone, particularly after induction and the person has been put to sleep, and especially, of course, if they've already lost a lot of blood, are operated on the upright position, which is more common in neurosurgery, or have intraoperative events, which I'll leave to your imagination, but if you are in Washington, where we have many more attorneys per capita than any other city in the country, you may know about some of those. Anyway, it turns out that blood pressure variability, meaning a greater than 20% change compared to baseline during surgery, is much more extreme in chronically hypertensive patients. And this was first told to us back in 1953 when Smithwick and Thompson reported that hypertensive people who were undergoing sympathectomy had a six-fold rate of major cardiovascular events compared to normotensives. Of course, these were all people undergoing sympathectomies. And who would do a sympathectomy in a person who didn't need it? But this is not something that we talk about outside of Boston. Anyway, then Lee Goldman and his colleagues looked at 1,001 operations and 19 post-op fatalities at the Massachusetts General Hospital, often known as Mass Greatest Hospital, in 1977. Neither acute blood pressure nor a history of hypertension was a significant predictor of those deaths. Now, that was a rather small sample. Granted, it was done in a very specialized and very special place, but the National VA Surgical Quality Improvement Program examined data from a whole lot more people, 417,000 plus people from 1991 and 97, and found neither blood pressure preoperatively nor the history of hypertension is amongst the top 10 predictors of 30-day morbidity and mortality. And I made a table here to show you what were the predictors of morbidity in the total farthest slide on your right. Being from Yakima, it's always good to be on the right. And mortality, which is in the middle. They are ranked in order of mortality, but you'll see the changes are a little bit different in the morbidity rank. Three, for example, is operative complexity for morbidity, but number eight for mortality. But the important thing to show you is that hypertension or pre-op blood pressure does not appear on this list anywhere. And that's important because pre-op hypertension or history of hypertension is not important, whereas hypertension in the post-anesthesia care unit is important. And granted, these data are from Canada, so they're from Toronto, so they probably don't make any difference to those of us who are proper red-blooded taxpaying American citizens. But nonetheless, hypertension defined as a systolic blood pressure higher than 20% over the pre-op for at least 15 minutes had a prevalence of 2% in their series, and unplanned ICU admission, that rate that was about 11-fold higher, excuse me, and in-hospital mortality rate that it was about six-fold higher. Tachycardia, defined as a heart rate greater than 120 beats per minute, was less common, but it was similarly associated with an eight-fold increase in planned ICU admission and about an eight-fold increase in in-hospital mortality rate. So hypertension after anesthesia turns out to be something that anesthesiologists pay a lot more attention to than hypertension before the patient is put to sleep. So here's the meta-analysis published in the British Journal of Anesthesiology. Notice the proper spelling. 30 observational studies were meta-analyzed, 1,132 people with cardiovascular events. The risk for the cardiovascular event was 35%. Contrast that, in fact, with most any of the other major risk factors we'll talk about in a minute that increase the risk by 6 to 12-fold, not 0.35-fold. Before 2014, in the days of yore, most guidelines considered acute hypertension, that is a blood pressure greater than 180 over 110, as a minor risk factor for cardiovascular complications after non-cardiac surgery based on the observational studies and the meta-analysis I just showed you. As a result, I can remember that elective procedures were often delayed or deferred or canceled if the pre-op blood pressure exceeded 180 over 110, and notice that there is no evidence that supports this practice. I'm happy that I'm not speaking in front of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons today, because they would tell me, of course there's no evidence. It's obvious. We all know that. And therefore, it's clear. But anyway, it turns out that mild hypertension, meaning blood pressure between 140 over 90 and 178 over 108, prior to anesthesia was not an independent risk factor for cardiovascular complications, nor was history of hypertension based on those meta-analysis that I've just shown you. So this gave us the 2014 Revised Cardiac Risk Index, RCRI. You get 1 point if you have chronic kidney disease, chalk one up for the nephrologist, 1 if you have heart failure, 1 if you have insulin-dependent diabetes. Notice that taking all those medicines doesn't matter. High-risk surgery, defined as endothoracic, intra-abdominal, or supra-inguinal vascular procedures, history of stroke or TI, and ischemic heart disease. If you get 1 point for either of those, if you've got 2 points altogether, you have elevated risk. And then it is recommended that you consider exercise or pharmacological stress testing and maybe revascularization before an elective procedure and maybe beta blockade. This was back in 2014 before the untoward events that I will reveal in about 6 minutes actually happened. So notice again that hypertension, acute or chronic, is not listed amongst the risk factors recommended for perioperative risk assessment. It doesn't matter to anesthesiologists. Not that they don't care, it just doesn't matter in terms of risk assessment. And notice that there are no, in 2014, there were no blood pressure thresholds that might be used to delay, postpone, or cancel the surgery. This again is news to anesthesiologists because they know this is true. This is what I was taught, therefore it is correct. Most authorities say that we should continue to follow the 2007 guidelines and probably cancel elective surgery if the pre-op blood pressure is greater than 180 over 110. And yet hypertension is intimately involved in the pathogenesis of 5 of the 6 risk factors on the previous slide. I won't remind you too much about this, but chronic kidney disease, major issue. Heart failure, major issue. Insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, probably important. History of stroke or TIA, for sure. Ischemic heart disease, not much doubt. So the reality is that, you know, hypertension is sort of a primordial risk factor here. It's not perhaps a risk factor for each of these things, but is a risk factor for the risk factors. All right, enough of that. Moving on. So these are the challenges for evidence-based medicine for hypertension and perioperative risk. There are very few, if any, studies that have evaluated risk in patients with pre-op blood pressures between 140 to 179 over 90 to 109 millimeters of mercury. There's a couple. There's a French one. There's a Belgian one. But neither of those are very interesting and certainly not relevant to us if we're getting out of NATO. Anyway, there is no published evidence that compared outcomes in patients with pre-op blood pressures greater than 180 over 110 whose surgery was delayed compared to those who underwent surgery anyway with a proper, testosterone-filled anesthesiologist. Many studies of pre-op blood pressure used a single blood pressure measurement taken under less than ideal conditions. And as a proper hypertensionologist, I can tell you that we get really nervous about people who take one blood pressure and call it a day, because blood pressure is not like that in the real world. I should only remind you about the cover of Sir Thomas Pickering's book called High Blood Pressure, that in fact has an interesting embossed S-shaped curve in behind the title. The title's in silver lettering. The embossed piece you can barely see unless you run your hands over it. That was the blood pressure curve of Sir Thomas Pickering one evening when he and Mrs. Pickering got together and had things that we don't talk about in Washington, D.C. He had an intra-arterial line in at the time, and that was a recording of his blood pressure during that interesting encounter. Piece of medical trivia, but you got to bring sex into things after lunch, otherwise nobody pays attention, right? Okay, anyway. All right, so anyway. Many studies used only surrogate markers for adverse outcomes. For example, some used intraoperative EKG measurements and called that a cardiac event. I'm not so sure that's true. Anyway, let's talk about antihypertensive agents in the perioperative setting, one of my favorite topics. Older blood pressure medications probably should not be used, and that's because they have unpredictable acute blood pressure responses, and so the current guidelines recommend against first-line perioperative or preoperative institution of nitroglycerin, hydralazine, enalapril, or its diethyl ester, enalaprilat, sodium nitroprusside, primarily because of thiocyanate and cyanide toxicity, clonidine, and I'll come back to that point in a minute, as well as other alpha-2 adrenergic agonists, and even beta blockers, and that's so controversial, we'll have to spend 4 or 5 minutes talking about that in a few minutes. Anyway, the idea of using pre-op clonidine was sort of rational. It's certainly true that marked activation of the sympathetic nervous system occurs in the perioperative system and the perioperative period. Some of this is due to anxiety and stress and, people's catecholamines go off the roof, et cetera. So it was thought that low-dose clonidine, which blunts central sympathetic outflow, might prevent blood pressure surges, tachycardia, myocardial infarction, and death, maybe even better than placebo. So the POISE 2 trial was done. It was a double dummy. And by that, I don't mean that both the patients and the doctors in the study were dummies. By that, I mean that it used two kinds of placebos, one for clonidine and one for aspirin. Those were dummy pills, and so that's why it's double dummy. It's got nothing to do with the acumen of the patients or the doctors. But anyway, they did this factorial design clinical trial 4 to 6 hours before surgery. They either gave clonidine 0.2 milligrams orally and then a patch each day for 3 days thereafter, or aspirin 200 milligrams, and it was not done in the United States. That's why aspirin is the 200 milligram dose. It seems weird to us, right? I mean, what is that? That's like a 2.5 baby aspirin? 2.5 babies? What is that? I don't know. Anyway. And then 100 milligrams for 30 days. So this was the regimen. It was not done in the United States, as I said. That's why the doses are weird. But they did enroll 10,010 subjects. The primary outcome was death or non-fatal heart attack over 30 days. And interestingly enough, this is the Poise 2 Kaplan-Meier plot for clonidine versus placebo. You'll notice that A, it wasn't significant, but B, it also showed that clonidine had more people having the primary outcome than did placebo. And if you are a reasonable person, as most juries are said to want to have, you would probably wish to take placebo instead of clonidine in this particular circumstance. This was the subgroup analysis. Notice that if the person, in fact, had neuraxial anesthetics, they did a little better, but it wasn't significant. Notice also that if they had a revised cardiac risk index in the middle of the slide there that was higher until it got really high, that also increased your risk of the primary outcome event. And that kind of validates, if you will, the revised cardiac risk index and makes us a little happier with the fact that it did actually predict risk reasonably well in people at reasonably low risk, not so much at the higher risk, but there were not so many people in that particular subgroup. Anyway, this is the table that I've made, and as you can see, the primary outcome, again, 8% higher, not significant. In fact, if you look at this, none of the first bunch of things are, in fact, events that were statistically significant. Death of cardiovascular event, death, heart attack, atrial fibrillation, dialysis or stroke, no significant difference across the board. Notice, however, that on the bottom in the blue, because it makes me depressed to talk about it, that's why I've chosen the blue color, I hope that's okay with you. The point is, hypotension was 32% more common in people who got clonidine compared to placebo, and bradycardia, shockingly, was also more common by 49% compared to those who took placebo. Now, if you know anything about clonidine, and many nephrologists do, because they use it like water in their dialysis patients just because it works, the good news is that you would have predicted these kind of adverse effects probably from the very beginning. So anyway, the conclusions were that neither clonidine nor aspirin reduced cardiovascular morbidity and mortality when given in the perioperative period. Clonidine was associated with significantly more hypotension and more bradycardia. Aspirin was associated with significantly more bleeding. Is anybody shocked by that? Anyway, so the conclusion was neither clonidine nor aspirin can be routinely recommended for pre and perioperative reduction of cardiovascular risk in general surgery patients, which is why the surgeons don't want me to talk about this, because we knew that. We wouldn't have given any of our patients that stuff anyway. It's those weird interloper people that had the idea that this might be helpful. All right, now we get into things that are gospel, and it's a little troublesome for me because I usually don't go to temple on Saturday. But instead to church on Sunday. But nonetheless, this is gospel. ACE inhibitors, as you all know, are really troublesome to anesthesiologists and surgeons. And the reason is that because from 1984 to 92, at least 11 reported cases in the English literature of refractory hypotension after induction of anesthesia were reported in patients taking chronic ACE inhibitors. That's 11 cases. That doesn't rank very highly in the hierarchy of medical evidence. I searched the entire medical literature and could find only one randomized trial. 51 subjects were told to either continue or hold their chronic ACE inhibitor on the morning of surgery. 16 of 21 who took the ACE inhibitor on the morning of surgery had systolic blood pressure less than 90 and require IV ephedrine at induction, compared to only 6 of 30 whose ACE inhibitor was held. P less than 0.005, QED proven, end of story, QED, we're done. It's so important they don't want me to move on to the next slide. You may wonder about ARBs. My students don't understand ARBs. They call them ACE2s. But anyway, 1999, 12 of 12 patients treated with chronic ARBs and 18 of 27 treated with chronic ACE inhibitors developed refractory hypotension, typically requiring ephedrine and or vasopressin after induction of anesthesia. These were significantly higher than observations in a simultaneous cohort of patients receiving calcium antagonists, beta blockers, or both. So they therefore propose that ARBs are even more troublesome than ACE inhibitors and that an ARB or an ACE inhibitor should be held before general anesthesia on the morning before the operation to avoid this. Here is the only data from a proper observational, non-randomized cohort study that backs up this piece of gospel. In 2005, Mayo Clinic investigators studied 267 patients undergoing general anesthesia. And it's interesting how they decided who did what. Half the anesthesiologists at Mayo at the time actually routinely let the patient take whatever was their antihypertensive medicine normally on the morning of surgery, no problem at all. And half of them had read the literature that I just summarized for you and said, oh yes, we always hold ACEs and ARBs in our patients undergoing general surgery. It turned out 144 of the people had induction of anesthesia less than 10 hours after dose of an ACE or an ARB. 123 had their dose held for more than 10 hours before anesthesia. And they counted the number of people who ended up with severe hypotension, meaning a systolic blood pressure of less than 65 millimeters of mercury, which I think most of us would agree is pretty low. And that was seen of 21 of 144 and 14 of 123 patients in both of those groups, p equals 0.44. No significant difference. Still common in both. However, moderate hypotension, a secondary endpoint, systolic less than 90, was seen in 87 of 144 and 57 of 123, and that p was 0.02, and that adjusted odds ratio was 1.74, and it was just barely significant. This, my friends, is in fact the evidence on which the policy of always holding ACE and ARB on the morning of surgery is based. It is gospel, it is given us from Mayo Clinic and anesthesiology, and therefore is prima facie correct. So, what is the compromise? Well, several smaller, poorly or uncontrolled studies have not shown an increase in perioperative hypotension when RAS blockers were given in the morning before general anesthesia, but, you know, uncontrolled things, hierarchy of medical evidence, never mind. Similarly, several small studies show no perioperative hypotension after local or regional anesthetics, so those might be a different story. My favorite way to sort of integrate all this is to quote, as usual, the British, who say, and I quote, "Primary care physicians should not try to influence the anesthetist's management of the perioperative patient, and anesthetists should not diagnose or start chronic hypertensive treatment of the patient's blood pressure. They are silos. You're not to mess with a gas passer, and the gas passer is not supposed to mess with your regimen for hypertension." That's what the British say. All right. As I mentioned, there is a controversy about beta blockers. Several meta-analyses, and I'll show you several of the panels from those, eventually comprising 17 studies with more than 12,000 subjects, concluded that routine beta blocker therapy given to non-cardiac surgery patients pre- and perioperatively significantly reduced the subsequent risk of all-cause mortality, cardiovascular events, especially non-fatal heart attack, by 31%, by the way, that's pretty impressive, and atrial fibrillation. And so you may wonder, especially given the educational objectives for today, why is this clear, distinct, and obviously beneficial thing controversial? And the answer is because the methods and conclusions of the three largest and most often cited trials have been challenged. And now we get into ethics and scientific integrity. So, moving on maybe, there we are. So, why are these concerns up there? The first author of the Decrease family of studies resigned from the faculty of the Erasmus University after its investigative committee on academic integrity and concluded that they, quote, were unable to confirm or dispel doubts about the care with which the study was conducted or the study's integrity. That's serious. The POISE 1 trial, which we'll go through in detail here in a moment, has been criticized because it started 100 milligrams of metoprolol succinate orally. Why is that important? Because if you think back to your clinical pharmacology class, metoprolol succinate is not metoprolol tartrate. Metoprolol tartrate gets into the blood pretty quickly after ingestion. Metoprolol succinate is the slow-release formulation, which if you give it to 2 hours or 4 hours before surgery, probably has a plasma concentration well nigh on to zero. Not to worry. Anyway, the results showed a 27% reduction in 30-day heart attack rate, but there was sadly an increase in death by 33%, an increase in stroke by 117%, and I'm using percentages here rather than absolute numbers just to make it look more impressive, hypotension by 55% and bradycardia by 174%. So sure, we can prevent some of the heart attack, but we're going to have a lot of other issues that we're going to have to deal with. Why did they choose metoprolol succinate, you're asking? And the answer was, of course, the patent was already off metoprolol tartrate, and they could only get the manufacturers of metoprolol succinate to pay for the study. Oh well. Anyway, moving on. So here's one of the meta-analyses. This one actually comes from Circulation 2014. You'll notice the big box in the middle there is POISE. You notice the two boxes sort of below the subgroup there are the two DECREASE studies, DECREASE 1 and DECREASE 4. Notice that, in fact, these, in fact, account for 92.37% of the data. The rest of it put together doesn't give you very much. So if you do what they do in Boston, ban these studies, You end up with something that looks like that. Notice that under these circumstances, poise is still given, but it's on the bottom of the thing. If we leave that out again, as I said before, we end up with a non-significant reduction in non-fatal heart attack 30 days in the post-operative period. The whole thing goes away. So this is why it's controversial. And on we may go. My batteries are getting... Next slide. Maybe. There we go. So the conclusions of the meta-analysis were that perioperative beta blockade started less than a day before cardiac surgery helps to prevent non-fatal heart attack but increases stroke, death, hypotension, and bradycardia. That's what the original meta-analysis said. The redo of this and the ACC guidelines say there are insufficient robust data on the efficacy and safety of perioperative beta blocker regimens that used agents other than metoprolol or initiated treatment 2 to 45 days prior to anesthesia. So that's the state of the art at the moment. What do the most recent guidelines say? This is the 2014 American Heart Association, American College of American College of Cardiology Foundation guidelines. They say that beta blockers should be continued in patients undergoing surgery who have taken them chronically. Duh. Anybody ever heard of rebound? Sure enough, they do it in basketball. Secondly, it's reasonable to use clinical circumstances to guide use of beta blockers after surgery. Well, that's nice. It allows doctors to do what seems to be most appropriate for the patient. I think that's probably okay. It may be reasonable to start perioperative beta blockers in patients with ischemia noted on pre-op evaluation, but notice that's a 2B and class C recommendation, whereas it may be reasonable to start beta blockers before surgery for patients with greater than 3 or more the revised cardiac risk factor index risk factors. That's a little redundant, but it means for high-risk patients, maybe we should be more intensive in our treatments, and I think that's kind of a precept of preventive medicine. Second piece is that uncertain benefits accrue after initiating beta blockers to reduce cardiovascular risk in pre-surgical patients with compelling chronic indication for this class of drug, despite having no RCRI risk factors. That's a class B, 2B rather, and capital B class recommendation. In patients in whom long-term beta blocker therapy is initiated, it may be reasonable to start the drug more than a day before surgery. That avoids the data of poise and so forth and allows you to ignore it when making conclusions. But starting beta blockers on the day of surgery is very likely harmful and should not be routinely done. That's a class 3 recommendation, but B. All right, so, whoops, back one. Hit it too hard. I'm skipping there. All right, so what does the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology Foundation recommend in terms of drugs? The answer is none. They make no such recommendations. However, I can tell you, having a couple of friends who are anesthesiologists, they favor clavulanate intravenously because it was used in the ECLIPSE trials. The ECLIPSE is a large family of studies, mostly run by Saul Aronson and his colleagues, one of my former colleagues in Chicago. But anyway, in the ECLIPSE studies, they compared clavulanate against several other comparators, and they had significantly lower mortality than nitroprusside in one study, and better tight blood pressure control than either nitroglycerin or nicardipine in two other studies. So that's, I think, why anesthesiologists pull out the clavulanate first whenever they need something that's going to lower the blood pressure quickly and easily and non-toxically in patients undergoing surgery. Esmolol is an IV drug, very much more useful for lowering heart rate than blood pressure. Phenoldepam, one of my favorite drugs, has been studied after cardiac surgery, and there was no significant difference in renal outcomes, including dialysis. So in the nephrology forum, I should badmouth it. On the other hand, it is the only agent that we have that acutely improves renal parameters, including eGFR, sodium excretion, and urinary flow. And then, of course, there's metoprolol. I think IV makes the most sense, but they got the company that makes the succinate to pay for poise one, and that, I think, was a trouble. So this is what the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology Foundation says should be your algorithm for treating patients who are facing elective non-cardiac surgery. And I sort of took this one exactly as it was given in color form in the guideline for two reasons. Number one, it's got all their original recommendations in it. And number two, it's so small you can't read it. So this is the one I use. It's a little easier to read. It also has a few less branch points, and I don't like those rhomboidal branch point decision makings. So notice, if the person comes in and has is scheduled for emergent or urgent surgery, you don't really have time. You know, he's got some horrible thing that happened to orthopedic injuries, et cetera, et cetera. So under those circumstances, what do? You proceed with surgery regardless of blood pressure. You manage the perioperative blood pressure and cardiovascular disease as best you can. That's kind of a gimme. However, if it's not emergent or urgent surgery, then the decision has to be taken, is there active high-risk cardiovascular disease present, meaning heart failure, valvular disease, coronary heart disease, or dysrhythmias? Then I think if there is, maybe the internist ought to be thinking about postponing the elective surgery and optimizing treatment of blood pressure and cardiovascular condition before the person is subjected to anesthesia. I think most anesthesiologists would actually appreciate that approach. Secondly, if the person doesn't have active high-risk cardiovascular disease, then I think it's worthwhile to calculate the revised cardiac risk factor index. And I've given you on previous slides the website to do that. And if it's greater than 2, as I said in this slide, then maybe a test of functional status is appropriate. I personally favor the regular treadmill, but there are people who say it's not sufficiently sensitive and so forth. But my theory is if you can go more than 4 METs on the treadmill with no symptoms and no major troubles on your cardiogram, it's probably okay to proceed to the idea of having surgery. If, on the other hand, you can't do 4 METs and so forth, or if it's unknown, you don't have a treadmill in your office, then maybe consider a referral to another person who might want to do a stress test, maybe a catheterization, for God's sake, and maybe revascularization, which is, of course, the answer to everything, because once the person is revascularized, all of these problems allegedly go away. And if you believe that, go join the American College of Surgeons, Osteopathic Surgeons Convention across the hall. They have many more little wonderful comments like that. Anyway, so if your RCRI is less than 2, you can proceed with surgery, and you can treat blood pressure if it's greater than 180 over 110 acutely, manage lower blood pressures on a case-by-case basis. On the other hand, if you do send the person with the elevated RCRI to the functional status test and they meet that, then you have a branch point, which I don't really have a strong sense of what I can do here, because that decision in my institution is made by anesthesiologists in the pre-anesthesia assessment office. What the internist says about what the internist thinks is appropriate doesn't matter. This came to me most recently when one of my patients for 30 years, who has really bad white coat hypertension, had a huge tumor in her chest. And the anesthesiologist looked at her, looked at the tumor, and said, "We're not going to touch that lady. Her blood pressure is 212 over 120. Of course, she was, you know, anxious and nervous and worried off the wall. So I had to spend a half an hour talking to the anesthesiologist, talking him down from that. But anyway, they eventually did put her to sleep, but it wasn't a very easy thing to have done. Anyway, so on we go to the last slide, I hope. Come on. There it is. There's my conclusions. My opinion. Delay of elective surgical procedures due to too high blood pressure is quite common. After it happens, I think the internist ought to reconsider the timing of antihypertensive drugs. There are some data from Spain that show that if you shift one of the antihypertensive drugs to be taken in the evening instead of in the morning, it reduces overall cardiovascular and all-cause mortality. Second thing is, I think it's worth thinking about white coat hypertension, because it is one of my favorite topics and something in which I could spend the rest of the afternoon, but you'd be bored to tears. But the point is that white coat hypertension was not in the vocabulary of most anesthesiologists that I've talked to. And so you tell them the person has white coat hypertension, they say, "Great, I'll just take my white coat off," which does no good at all. And lastly, yes, maybe it is a reasonable thing to consider rescheduling a procedure. As I said, most anesthesiologists recommend taking all antihypertensive agents on the morning of scheduled surgery, except for ACE inhibitors and ARBs, and I've shown you the data on which this recommendation is based. If I was an anesthesiologist, I would hang my head at how strong they believe in this on the basis of very little evidence. But anyway, it is true that these drugs can cause and may cause excessive hypotension after induction, and since most of us don't go to the OR with our patients, we don't know about it until after the fact. And thirdly, perioperative initiation of clonidine is not indicated in the United States anyway. It's not indicated by the FDA. It's not included in the package insert information. It would be an off-label use, and therefore I do not recommend it. Beta blockers are controversial, but generally discouraged unless the patient has a compelling indication that should have been treated with a beta blocker before surgery. In my opinion, that's something that the internist should have been able to figure out before you sentence the person to surgery and take care of it before that dangerous hour appears. So with that, I'm done. I thank you for your attention.